Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to New Books Network. I'm Tiadam Silongkumar, the host of this channel. Today, I'm here with Elle Hardy to talk about her book, Beyond Belief, How Pentecostal Christianity is Taking Over the World. Now, I think the title of the book itself is clear about what this book is trying to talk about, but it's a privilege for me to sit and talk with Elle here. And we are going to go deep into the aspect of Pentecostalism and how it is spreading over the world. So it's my privilege to welcome Elle to the New Books Network. Tell me something about yourself. Yeah.
Well, first of all, thank you for having me. Second of all, something about myself. Well, as you can probably hear from my voice, I'm Australian, but I'm kind of based between in the US and in London. I'm a journalist.
Quite interesting that you wrote this book. So what made you write this book?
So a few years ago, I was working on a story in Waco, Texas, about what's called the John School Movement in Texas. That actually forms a chapter of the book. And I was spending some time with people who ran a John School. So they're schools for men who are convicted of soliciting sex for the first time, because it's still largely illegal in America. And they're sort of put through a remediation course, a bit like if you get done for drink driving or something like that, you know, you got to watch some videos and listen to some people speak and, you know, sort of take a day off work. And yeah, the people that were running the course didn't really want me around, but they were letting me there anyway. And, you know, that happens sometimes, but I sort of figured out after a few days that it was largely because they took their inspiration to open the school from an Australian woman called Christine Kane. She's very big on the kind of sisterhood circuit in the US. She's a Hillsong alumni. And yeah, so they were kind of trying to pay something back, I think, to Australians, or I'm not sure what it was. And then I started reading about Christine, and I actually did a story on her and found it quite interesting, and then sort of started getting into the Hillsong stuff, and it was just sort of in, you know, interviewing some academics and getting my head around the scope of Pentecostalism that I realized how big of a global phenomenon it is, and something that I think's really gone under the radar in my profession, you know, which is fairly mainstream secular liberal journalism. And just speaking to various friends and editors, it was something that they weren't really aware of either. So I read a few good academic books looking at the global scope of the movement, you know, everywhere from the Koreas to sub-Saharan Africa, Latin America, and even in the West. And and I decided to do sort of a popular version of, well, a popular account, you know, a non-academic global look at the movement, because it was something that I just felt hadn't really been covered.
Yeah, I think that is also what is an interesting aspect of this book, that you bring out the, you know, lived conversations and all of those aspects which can be accessible by anyone, and also, you know, through all of those conversations and all of those things that is going on, you know, we can really have a grasp of what is really going on here. So going straight into the book itself, one of the things that I think needs to be also cleared here is the question of what is Pentecostalism, right? And to do that, I think I would like you to talk about a little bit about the history of it. So, yeah.
Sure. So I mean, look, the definition can be a little bit contentious. And again, I stress I'm not an academic. So I'm really looking at people whose whose evangelical Christianity is really centered around the power of the Holy Spirit. So that really comes from that Pentecostal movement that started with William J. Seymour in 1906 in Los Angeles at the Azusa Street Revival, and you know, really fanned quickly around the world. I mean, nowadays, I quote the 600 million Pentecostals in the world figure, which has sort of been established by Pew and some other researchers. So that combines the Pentecostals and charismatics, you know, particularly from the charismatic Catholic renewal movement in Latin America and others. But I mean, now particularly in the United States, Australia, the UK, you get a lot of these big mega churches that are quite certainly Pentecostal in origin, you know, often were ex-AOG, Assemblies of God churches, that will now call themselves non-denominational. And to my mind, that is largely just a branding exercise. You just don't want to exclude people or, you know, Pentecostalism in some places, particularly in the United States, still can have a stigma in some areas, you know, of quivering and tongues talking and all of that. And they, you know, and your Hillsongs and some other of those, you know, really big mega churches really want to, you know, not so much be associated with that anymore. So it is difficult, but again, it really is that I'm defining it as people whose evangelical Christianity is really in harnessing the power of the Holy Spirit.
I think Pentecostalism also has its roots, so to say, in terms of revival, right? And so can you also say something about a revival here? Because again, recently, interestingly, in the Asbury University, there's a revival going on, and, you know, it's a very big sensation among the Christians. And I think revival has always been something that has been always longed by Christians, and also that has been something, you know, a kind of inversion in terms of how Christianity kind of envision the world. So can you say something about the connection to revival here? Yeah.
Sure. So I think revivals have always been very closely associated with the Pentecostal movement, again, from starting with William J. Seymour and just fanning out. I mean, there were revivals, I think was it the Welsh revival was in 1905, so before Seymour's, and there was a great Pyongyang revival in 1907, and then, you know, fanning out to revivals really all over the world. And, you know, quite a stunning phenomenon, because obviously sometimes they were taking things and learning things from each other and hearing about this great, you know, movement in the winds almost. But other times there isn't any great evidence of that. You know, some of these things did appear to be quite spontaneous, and I do find that quite fascinating. And I don't think revivals are as perhaps common now as they used to be. And, you know, they've been, if you think about the prominent ones that I certainly know about in North America in recent decades, I mean, there was the Toronto Blessing very famously in 1994, where you know, that was a massive revival, and you know, people were quite famously making animal noises and things like that, and you had to get some of the really big Pentecostal leaders like John Wimber just to tell everyone to calm things down a bit. And then, you know, Lakeland and some others in the United States. And yeah, it just doesn't seem as much of a phenomenon anymore that we get these, but they're certainly very powerful events. And what's happening right now, and it seems to be, I've been off reporting in Africa, so I haven't had that much time to have a look at it, what's going in Ashbury, I think it is. You know, it seems to be very led by young people. And I find that, you know, a very fascinating idea, because, you know, often we're seeing that younger people are engaging with faith and religion less and less now. But I think there's certainly, among those who do, you know, that there certainly is some evidence now of you know, becoming more fervent in their faith. And yeah, a revival like this, after what's been a very difficult few years, you know, where people weren't, people weren't allowed to come together and things like that. You know, I think perhaps in hindsight, maybe we would do a revival. But yeah, I think it's a very interesting phenomenon. Certainly something I'll be keeping an eye on, and you know, seeing how these things will be traveling now. I mean, there's going to be a lot of kids there with TikTok. People in other parts of the world going to be, you know, getting ideas from this? I think that's a really fascinating thing with how quickly these moments can catch on in other places now.
So when we talk about Pentecostalism, obviously one thing that is very, I mean, that one thing that immediately comes to picture is the Hillsong. And I think Hillsong has become a very big sensation in that sense around the world. So can you tell us something about the Hillsong and, you know, their branding of Pentecostalism? Yeah.
Yeah, so Hillsong, I mean, is a case in point. They were they were Assemblies of God, you know, for as long as they were around, and the and Brian Houston, the founder, his father Frank's churches, you know, had long been in Assemblies of God as well, and they are now one of these churches that are non-denominational. They call themselves One House with Many Rooms, but yeah, look, Hillsong has been an absolute phenomenon and really key to the third wave of the Pentecostal movement, or the neo-charismatic movement, as we tend to call it. And I mean, what's really interesting is that they really changed the business model. And, you know, this is coming from a place from my hometown of Sydney that, you know, evangelicals and Pentecostals just aren't very common there. And, you know, they've always been fairly sort of distrusted, and the mainstream media sort of never been very comfortable with the Hillsong phenomenon. But I mean, it's really taken off in so many places around the world, and they just really harness the power of music. And that's something Pentecostals have always been amazing at. But they made very palatable, you know, music with very credible production values. It sounded like something you could just as easily hear on your Spotify playlists, secular music. And they really pioneered what this form of Christianity can be for, you know, the late 20th and the early 21st century, which was that you can be a Christian in a secular world. You can have the good stuff as well. You don't have to go without, you know, Pentecostals are no longer, you know, sort of quivering premillennials waiting, you know, for the earthquake and Jesus' return. They're, you know, very forward-thinking, sophisticated people who are living, you know, who understand that they're living very much in a secular world and trying to live a Christian life. And yeah, they don't want to go without the good stuff. They want to feel good as well as feeling God. And Hillsong was amazing at that. And I mean, they've just pioneered this model that so many others have imitated. Hillsong's in all sorts of trouble now. I don't think it will ever get back to where it was. They've, you know, deposed the leader. He's on trial he's on trial for concealing his father's pedophilia. I was home in Sydney in December to cover that. There is just beset by constant scandal. There's another couple of court cases going on that are going to be looking at money and cultural issues. And I just don't see Hillsong getting back to where it was. But it really changed the way that a lot of places did church. And also now I've sort of become a cautionary tale. I mean, you know, they were famous for Justin Bieber going to worship at their church, for pastors like Carl Lentz, you know, becoming a celebrity and then having his own personal fall from grace. And so as much as they designed the new model, I think that they really are now the cautionary tale. And whatever the sort of, you know, next wave of this movement is going to be, I think it will be led perhaps by people who watched Hillsong's rise and then learned some of the lessons from it.
Now, when we talk about Pentecostalism, obviously it comes under purview of Christianity, and also within Christianity, obviously there are so many denominations and there are still debates going on all of those things. So I wanted to ask about what are some of the movements that might have influenced Pentecostalism? Obviously one thing that comes to mind is also the New Age movement. I mean, in terms of the purview as Christianity as a whole, you know, Pentecostalism, the debates that are going on there and some of the influences that are there in the movement itself. Can you elaborate something on that?
Yeah, I mean, look, that's incredibly complex. I mean, first off, it really came out of the Great Awakenings in the United States and the movements, you know, that brought up Mormonism and all sorts of changes in 19th century American Christianity. So it certainly came out of there, but also the some of the secular movements at the time, such as New Thought, and that sort of rugged individualism, the Ralph Waldo Emerson, you know, and that really went into, you know, the self-help movement of the 1950s with Norman Vincent Peale and the Power of Positive Thinking. His self-help book. He was actually a Reformed Lutheran minister, but this book went on to have a profound effect on the sort of early prosperity gospel preachers who were largely within the Pentecostal movement. Also went on to have a profound effect on a young guy called Donald Trump, who was in the front row of Peel's sermons at his church in New York. There's those things, and then obviously the New Age movement had a really profound movement on the really profound influence on the charismatic movement, or the second wave of the Pentecostal movement. So that was guys like Lonnie Frisbee. There's actually a new movie coming out about him, made by Kelsey Grammer, that I think once again overlooks Lonnie Frisbee's homosexuality. He died of AIDS and was really abandoned and written out of the movement. But that's a bit of a digression. This is the Jesus people, or the Jesus freak movement in 1960s California, where a lot of young people went up to the Summer of Love in Hyde-Ashbury, saw that it wasn't all it was cracked up to be, and sort of returned to their Christian roots. You know, a lot of kids that might have come from the Midwest or just from pretty, you know, typical 1950s American families that wanted to, you know, have some sort of spirituality that they didn't get from the New Age movement, and that, you know, had a hugely profound effect on Pentecostalism as we know it today. It really was, you know, the major part of the second wave of the charismatic movement. Pick your influence as well elsewhere. I mean, one of the great things and one of the great themes of my book is how much the movement looks and feels like the local culture. So in Latin America, it's, you know, we'll take, many more cues from Catholicism and from traditional cultures and from, you know, some of the imported cultures, you know, with African people who came over in the slave trade. In Africa, you know, there's Zionist movements, particularly in South Africa. But again, you know, we'll look and feel much more like traditional cultures, have, you know, potentially, you know, undergoing spiritual warfare against demons and spirits that appeared in traditional non-Christian African cultures. And so too in Korean cultures, you know, some of these shamanistic elements of their traditional non-Christian cultures. So, I mean, the influences are hugely profound, but that is certainly a big part of the movement is understanding that, because there is no central authority, you know, anyone with a following can basically be a preacher. And so it does look and feel like the local cultures, and that makes it more authentic to people. You know, it's sort of become apparent now that people don't want to be dictated from Rome about how to do God and how to do their faith. They want it to be something that is more meaningful in their everyday lives and to look and feel and sound like their culture, and that has certainly been a very big part of Pentecostalism's rise.
Now, I think in all of this movement, there's obviously a leader there are a few prominent leaders that has really envisioned certain movement and taken it forward, and all these leaders have a background and they have visions, and you know, there's a place where they come from and all of those aspects of a leader. So can you talk about some of the prominent leaders in the Pentecostal movement?
Sure. Well, I think two of the most influential figures of 20th century Pentecostalism are certainly John Wimbo, who came up in that charismatic movement out of California. He was actually in a band that was a forerunner of the Righteous Brothers, and I think he was there early on, their manager as well. And then C. Peter Wagner, who was another American, but who spent a lot of his time as a missionary in Latin America and in Argentina and Bolivia in particular, I think. And he really helped take some of Wimber's ideas on, you know, about giving the people what they want, you know, in the here and now, and power evangelism, as it was called. And then so that was Wimber's real idea. But then Wagner was able to really sort of take that and, you know, sort of do the next turn of the wheel. And he brought back ideas from Latin America, particularly around spiritual warfare and you know, really understanding that this was the center of the developing world is the center of Christianity now. And that Western Christians had a lot to learn from the developing world and also needed to treat it with respect and deference, I think. And he brought back to the United States some ideas on Christianity that he'd gotten in Latin America. But then he was also, you know, very much a part of the, I don't know if term's exactly right, but for want of a better word, the sort of neoliberalization of the third wave of the Pentecostal movement. I mean, I think that was just partially, you know, just the times and it was in the air, but he was also very good at sort of creating some of the more corporate structures around around the Pentecostal movement that we see now. I mean, there's all sorts of other really important figures. There's Agir Macedo in Brazil, who is head of the Universal Church of the Kingdom of God. Sorry, I think that's the right name. Who sort of almost single-handedly brought Pentecostalism to Brazil. There was a very small number of, Protestants and things, but he was converted and just really changed the landscape with his megachurch in Brazil, and he's now a billionaire. And just the effects of that, I mean, I'm in London at the moment and you see Universal Churches everywhere. They're also, doing a lot of real heavy duty missionary work in Portuguese speaking countries in Africa, like Mozambique and Angola and places like that. And then I think you have some of the Nigerian leaders as well. I mean, what's happening in Nigeria is incredible. So Pastor Adeboye started the Redeemed Christian Church of Christ, RCCC, in the 1980s, and put this huge megachurch out on the highway, the most traveled road in Lagos and Nigeria, and I think potentially all of Africa, just by virtue of Lagos being the biggest city there. And, putting this church out and understanding that, people were commuting hours each day had spiritual needs as well. And now you go out on the Lagos Ibadan Highway and it is just dotted with mega churches for miles. And, traffic can, there can be all day traffic jams when you go out there now, because there are, literally millions of people who might be out there at church at once. And just the revolution that he's brought about in these, the way of, West African Pentecostal faith, which is already pretty robust. And, from there now we see a lot of West African Christians, partaking in reverse evangelism. They're very big on, the West brought us the good news. And now, look at the West, it's falling apart, gay marriage and all of that. And there is a real movement within Nigerian Pentecostalism among others to re-evangelize the West. If there are churches opening in, Anglican churches and Methodist churches and whatnot are closing down in England every week, and they're, being replaced by Pentecostal churches, and they are by and large immigrant and minority churches, particularly from places like Nigeria. And so once again, it really is where the energy of the movement is right now.
The subtitle of this book is How Pentecostal Christianity is Taking Over the World. Now, I wanted to ask about the approach that they take in terms of reaching out to different countries, right? Because I think trying to reach out with a movement to different places or countries or a foreign place is not an easy thing. It needs resources, but also at the same time, it's the sensitivity to the places, but also at the same time, it needs a certain aspect of, okay, how do we grasp the attention of the people and, how do we make this movement appealing and all of those aspects. There's certain form of method that they follow to make the movement appealing. So can you elaborate on this one? Yeah.
Yeah, look, I mean, the title is a bit facetious in a way. It's slightly hyperbolic, and that's just journalism and selling books. So I don't really think it's taking over the world. But we were just trying to be a bit provocative. It's difficult to say, because once again, while there is a movement, there is no central authority. There is no one way of doing things. So you really do get guys freelancing. I mean, I follow all sorts of people that, just guys who just fundraise on social media and who travel the world evangelizing. There's a prominent American guy and a prominent British girl I follow who do this. And, they can go anywhere and try to start evangelizing and being sort of modern missionaries. I'm very wary of saying that there's anything deliberate or organized afoot, because it can, again, it could just be one pastor with one idea, a Nigerian pastor who's, opened up I think they're trying to open the biggest church in America in Texas. I think that's already happened. So it is very difficult, but obviously there are, Pentecostals are very good at building networks. So within, what can almost be considered a fourth wave of the movement now, the New Apostolic Reformation, it really is all about building apostolic networks, and they've been very global in reach, just because, these people go to conferences. I remember when David Yonggi Cho, another really prominent Pentecostal leader from South Korea, died a few years ago, And there was a prominent leader from Guatemala who put out, you know, a statement about mourning him because they'd become really close. And, you know, you don't traditionally associate Guatemala with South Korea. So there's all of these networks at play. So it is very difficult. I mean, there are individual cases. There was some pretty hard evangelizing, I think, from some Americans and Canadians in Uganda about 10 years ago that sort of sparked a real anti-LGBT movement, and there was, you know, some weird stuff around beliefs with AIDS, but yeah, there isn't, you know, there is no one concerted thing because, yeah, it's a movement, but there is no organization within it. There's no membership. So all sorts of people are reaching out in all sorts of places. You know, it's a real movement of migrants and diasporas. So you'll get, I mean, I did a story for The Guardian last year on people particularly from the subcontinent who are getting converted to Pentecostalism in the Gulf states in the Middle East, you know, in places like Saudi Arabia, Qatar, where you know, traditionally you think of, Christians aren't really welcome and certainly can't really practice their faith publicly. But a lot of migrants from, the Philippines and the subcontinent particularly are being converted there when they're workers, when they're, you know, have pretty miserable working conditions and need some sort of spiritual nourishment to get them through. And then these people return home often to, you know, India and Sri Lanka and things like that, and are opening up mega churches where I haven't had a chance to come to India yet, but it's quite a phenomenon there. So, you know, often it's people who are converts themselves who are going back to their homelands or something like that, and taking the faith. So it's really difficult to, you know, put a pin in, but we do know that, you know, the movement, the Pentecostal movement, is spreading incredibly fast. You know, there's about 600 million followers worldwide and counting. I think there's, you know, pretty good evidence that's probably getting up closer to 700 million now. And there are estimates that by 2050, there'll be 1 billion Pentecostals worldwide. So that's 1 in 10 people in 2050 will probably, you know, be a part of the faith movement. It's certainly spreading apace. And not only through conversions, but it's also spreading in places that still have very high birth rates. So places like Nigeria, Latin America and whatnot. So, I don't see it slowing down anytime soon.
Yeah, quite interesting. You know, the place where I come from, the particular state, Nagaland, and from early on, the Nagaland is populated by the Baptist Christians. So in terms of the population percentage-wise, Nagaland has the highest percentage of Baptist Christian in the world, actually. And interestingly, early on, actually, it had really significant Pentecostal influence, the Baptist Christianity here, actually. And also at the same time, there is a wave of Pentecostal Christianity here, which is kind of emerging very strongly in Nagaland. So that's a very interesting aspect that you're talking about. Yeah, quite interesting. Now, one of the characteristics, so to say, of Pentecostalism, not essentializing it, but is the prosperity gospel, as people call it. And I think this is something which people talk and debate about, and all of those aspects. So can you talk something about this one? Yeah.
Sure. So as I mentioned earlier, it really emerged out of 1960s America, so that really flourishing consumer culture, but also, you know, new mediums of mass media. So it was, you know, preachers who were able to tape sermons on cassette tapes and drive them around the country, and then, you know, people were starting to own their own cars more and more, and then so they could put it on and listen, and then syndicated radio and things like that. So again, it was really a product of its time, and Pentecostalism has just always been amazing at grabbing onto the zeitgeist, grabbing onto the new media from you know, its earliest days in 1906 to now, you know, social media. This is some sort of dynamism about it that just seems to get this stuff quicker than a lot of other denominations and faiths do. But prosperity gospel it's a tricky thing because I get asked about it a lot, you know, because people just think of, you know, someone, you know, running up to a Rolex preacher and handing over their car keys or whatever. But actual prosperity gospel, I think that's fairly old hat. So originally, I mean, there was a lot of that, you know, it's ideas of seeding, that if you plant a seed, then a harvest will grow. So, you know, if you give some of your, you know, if you tithe, or if you give over a bit of your cash to your church and your pastor, that will, you know, hold you in good stead, and God will reward you for your faith with your own riches. And I mean, that idea is still certainly prominent in large parts of Pentecostalism today. There aren't, you know, that, you know, you think of some of those American prosperity preachers, Joel Osteen and whatnot, and they're fairly rare these days, I think. But you know, certainly in the developing world, prosperity gospel is probably more prominent. You know, I saw a fair bit of it in Nigeria and Brazil. You know, they're just two huge countries and two countries I spend a lot of time in and have a lot of affection for. And I mean, what we're really seeing there is, and this is the real underlying, if it, you know, if there's one thing that we can put the growth of Pentecostalism down to, it's health and wealth. It's people who, you know, spiritual people who really want their spiritual needs met and nourished, but also they want some help in the material world, in the here and now. You know, they want a good life in this life as well as the next. And it really has become the faith of the working poor. So people are looking to ideas like prosperity gospel, whether or not they're explicitly saying it so much now, just because it can have a fairly dirty name. You know, it all depends on the church and the area and all those sorts of things. But it's still very much in existence. And I think where we're really seeing the wealth promises of Pentecostalism that you know, don't really fall under the prosperity gospel name so much, but it's the promise of Pentecostalism is, and there's quite a bit of academic research on this now, is that people who join Pentecostal churches tend to get their lives together. And Pentecostals are really great at giving testimony. So you hear this a lot, you know, sort of long services, there'll be people jumping up and telling you how they joined church and everything was fine. But you really see that, you know, people see it in their neighbors. You know, you're in a Brazilian favela, you're living cheek by jowl with your neighbors, and, you know, someone starts going to church and maybe they stop drinking. And so, you know, maybe they're able to get a promotion at work. And then maybe their kids are able to, you know, go to school for another couple more years. And you sort of see a whole family circumstances uplift very quickly. You'll also see things like Pentecostal preachers sort of almost being almost a mentor figure as much as a pastor figure. And so, you know, they'll say, you know, they'll say to someone in their congregation, you know, you say you hate your job at the factory. You've had this dream for years of opening up this, you know, fruit juice vending stand. You know, why don't you go for it? Everyone at the church will, you know, come and patronize you. And then so people start supporting each other's businesses within the church. So the sort of solidarity networks building. And once again, people tend to see an uplift in their circumstances. And so I think that's the really profound thing that's going on here. And more important than certainly prosperity gospel is these promises of prosperity that come with Pentecostal churches, and which seem to be, you know, there's plenty of anecdotal evidence, but we're seeing a lot of research evidence now is that people are just getting their lives together when they go to these churches. You know, once again, it's in, you know, some developing places, some pretty poor and desperate circumstances, where there isn't, you know, the state services to help people out. Churches are the only game in town for a lot of people. And Pentecostalism seems to work.
Now, another one is healing. I think healing is something which is very prominent in Pentecostalism, particularly. And people have different reasons as to, okay, some people are really into it, but then some other people criticize it, saying it as a bogus and all of those aspects. But I think healing is something which, if a person goes through it, or if a person has certain experiences of it, it becomes very intimate to that person. And I think that is an aspect of healing that is really interesting among any religion for that matter. And I think that is where I think Pentecostalism also has this prominence on the aspect of healing. So can you elaborate something on the aspect of healing? Yeah.
So I mentioned earlier that health and wealth are the two things that are really getting people into the tent, and healing is certainly a huge part of that. You're very correct. You know, traditionally Pentecostals did it by laying of hands, and that's often still quite common in services all over the world now. And once again, there is actually some research that has been queried by you know, people in the sciences, but you know, I found it quite compelling that came out of Mozambique of, you know, intercessory prayer, some people that were hard of hearing, and you know, just some of the people, I believe they had science backgrounds, but they were of faith, or I can't remember exactly what the study was. It's certainly referenced in the book. But, you know, just there, I interviewed them and their eyewitness accounts, and these are quite serious academics in the United States. You know, they were just saying that, yeah, something happened. We can't exactly explain what it is. And what they actually found at the time, and I think this is in about 2014, was that they tried to repeat these experiments over Skype at the time, I think, and they found it had no effect. And I was sort of, I was writing this in the pandemic, you know, and suddenly all of our lives went onto Zoom, and I found that quite powerful, that, you know, maybe there is something, there is something in the whole village coming together to pray for a person. And, you know, it's not all, I've seen a lot of showman mega preachers who have, you know, the people get up out of the wheelchairs, and that's obviously all bogus. And it's not to say that, you know, yeah, you can just pray your disability away for want of a better word. But, you know, maybe there is something in a lot of people coming together and the power of the human touch. I'm not a person of faith myself, but I did find the idea quite compelling. Again, that might have just been hope during the pandemic when I just wanted to touch other people again. But, you know, I did find that quite interesting. But yeah, healing is certainly a very, very important part of the Pentecostal movement. And I mean, look, it is everywhere, but again, in developing places among the working poor, even in the United States, you know, where healthcare is just out of reach of a lot of people now because it's so expensive. There was a real turn to the Pentecostal faith for healing. I've actually got a story coming out in the Guardian US in a couple of weeks about a very interesting Pentecostal group and the kind of people who were turning to it for healing, but I can't reveal too much now, but I'll certainly post it online when it's out. But yeah, we do just see over and over that, yeah, people are turning to their churches for healing, for hope. But also there's, you know, another small element of health, I think, that kind of goes under discussed within the movement. And that's just churches, again, providing, you know, essentially becoming parastate institutions in large parts of the world. You know, South Africa is falling apart at the moment and has a very, very pious, largely Pentecostal population. You know, Nigeria has terrible state services, you know, favelas of Brazil and Latin America, you know, these people are generally, you know, often the last in line. And just having a small healthcare clinic at your church, and Pentecostals aren't alone in this, but it certainly becomes, again, part of that meaning that gets tied into people's faith and gets more and more people in the tent as well. I mean, just having a small healthcare clinic on site, and, you know, some doctors who go to the church volunteering at it in Korea, that was a really prominent thing in the Korean Pentecostal megachurches in South Korea, where North Korean refugees were going around to churches, and, you know, there'd be a dentist there, so he'd say, "Oh, okay, yeah, you're a defector, a refugee. I'll do your teeth for free," because they had no other way of getting these services. So I think that is, you know, the more material aspect of faith as well, of just having a place where you can get some stuff that, I mean, in my ideal world, the state would be providing, but in so many parts of the world, they're not. And yeah, once again, just building these solidarity networks, giving people stuff in the here and now as well as the ever after.
Now, I have a last question, and that is related to Pentecostalism and politics. Now, obviously, I mean, in Pentecostalism, the spiritual world and the, you know, the physical world, the worldly affairs is separated, but also they also see that, you know, look at worldly affairs in terms of politics as something which they need to look after, because obviously the judgment, the end time, and then the politics is something which will bring forward their, so to say, the spiritual agendas in that sense. So I think politics is something which is very important for Pentecostalism, and also at the same time, they have a lot to say on all of those aspects. So can you say something about Pentecostalism and politics? Yeah,
sure. I mean, that is a large part of my book. So I guess especially the first kind of half of the book is really trying to understand why so many people are joining this movement. And the second half is looking at some of the real politicization of the movement and why I ultimately sort of say it's taking over the world and probably not in the best way that I think it has been used for not good ends by some not such good people. But yeah, I think there has been a real confluence between, you know, sort of the populist right-wing movements that we're seeing around the world and Pentecostalism. So, you know, even Viktor Orban in Hungary, Jair Bolsonaro in Brazil, Donald Trump in the United States, Rodrigo Duterte in the Philippines, they all were elected, you know, on populist waves with very strong Pentecostal support. Trump in the United States, and I know we're all a bit sick of talking about him, but you know, it's a phenomenon. And it was the Pentecostals who got behind him first. A lot of other evangelicals sort of weren't, you know, they wanted Ted Cruz or someone who was a bit more like them. Pentecostals like Paula White Cain and a few other prominent leaders really got behind Trump first. And there are a lot of prophecies and things like that. And I really think that just because we keep seeing it being replicated around the world, and, you know, there's a lot of leaders in sub-Saharan Africa, you know, who have very close relationships with preachers. But what we've really seen, I think, is two things. It's the politics, and it's the style as well. So the style and substance behind it. I think just in terms of style, I mean, it is about, you know, being really good on stage. It's about stagecraft. Pentecostals from the beginning have been great preachers. They're people, you know, it's the most charismatic guy in the village. You don't really have to have the educational qualifications. You just have to have a following and be good at what you do. And Pentecostals, you know, I always think about, you know, The Simpsons and like Reverend Lovejoy and everyone's sort of falling asleep. You just don't get that in Pentecostal churches because they wouldn't survive. So you do see leaders, you know, with a great sense of an audience's waning attention, how to make sermons snappy, how to make them relevant. I go to see, you know, I've been to so many churches around the world, and these are preachers that are, you know, talking about things, you know, in relation to Facebook. And, you know, they're quite clearly giving a riff on, you know, not coveting your neighbor's goods and things like that, but putting it into context that people understand and that people want to hear, and you know, putting it into the, you know, vernacular. And I think that that's a really important part of it. And just, you know, making a show. I mean, Trump rallies are, you know, horrible and nonsensical, but people enjoy them. You know, they laugh, they're singing, they're fun, they're entertained the whole time. And that's certainly a very important thing. But I mean, also the substance or the politics, why they're really alighting. You know, Pentecostalism is very much about what you're experiencing and what you're feeling rather than, you know, words in the good book. And that's very much, you know, what a lot of this populist politics is as well. It's, you know, we don't need your science. We don't need your vaccines. I'm, you know, I believe this because I feel this. And so we see a real merger of those two things. And I think, you know, more importantly, it is really about, there is a movement both within a lot of, you know, not all Pentecostals, but within a lot of people of faith, and within a lot of people on the, you know, sort of populist right, for want of a better word worldwide, that are feeling, you know, besieged by the secular liberal world around them. You know, that this, you know, corporate sense of everything being very woke now because you don't want to turn off potential customers, of, you know, you know, sports people taking a knee, or, you know, making political messages like that. You know, a lot of people of both the Pentecostal persuasion and the, you know, sort of populist right persuasion will mention these things a lot, that they feel like they're getting these messages from everywhere, and that they are, you know, being sort of called dinosaurs and old fashioned and things like that for having, you know, traditional beliefs, for being against gay marriage and things like that. And that's where I certainly think that some of these new populist right figures have really been able to gain a very strong foothold among Pentecostals because of both of those issues of style and substance that I mentioned.
So as a journalist, in the few coming months ahead or days ahead, what are the things that you are going to do now? Yeah. Any plans?
Well, I have a big story coming out in The Guardian soon, which I mentioned about a Pentecostal group in Arizona, which I think will be quite interesting. But I currently have a podcast out through iHeartRadio on the sort of rise and fall of Hillsong megachurch that we mentioned earlier. Episode 4 just came out yesterday. So I think that's pretty cool. I mean, other than that, Nigerian election is on tomorrow. I haven't had the opportunity to go and cover it myself, but that's one to watch, and there'll be a really huge role for some of the big Pentecostal preachers in that. Other than that, I don't think I've got anything else major coming out at the moment, but you never know.
Thank you very much, Elle, for being here at New Books Network. I mean, I really enjoyed this conversation with you, and you know, you have really tackled the topics really clearly. And as you have said, you are not an academician, you said, but I think you have really explained the things very clearly. And the book itself suggests that the way it is written and how it explores the lives of the people and history and all of those aspects are really amazing. And I think I encourage everyone listening to this podcast to really get a hold of that book and go through it, that you will be amazed. Yeah. Thank you very much, Elle, for being here at New Books Network.
That's so kind. Thank you for having me.